Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Laura Waterman has been described as mountain royalty. With her late husband, Guy Waterman, she's written numerous articles and books on the outdoors, including the definitive 900-page classic, Forest and Crag, A History of Hiking, Trailblazing, and Adventure in the Northeast Mountains. The Watermans were pioneering philosophers of wilderness ethics and are often credited as the inspiration for the modern Leave No Trace movement of low-impact camping and hiking. Laura Waterman may seem like an improbable crusader and chronicler of wilderness. She grew up on the campus of the Lawrenceville School, an elite prep school in New Jersey where her father taught English and was a renowned scholar of Emily Dickinson. In the early 1960s, Laura got a job in publishing in New York City, where she met her future husband, Guy, who'd been a speechwriter for Presidents Eisenhower, Nixon, and Ford, and for General Electric. In 1973, the young couple left the big city and became homesteaders on a 27-acre plot of land in East Corinth, Vermont. Together, they wrote books and were stewards of the Franconia Ridge, home to a spectacular and popular skyline trail in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. In 2000, Laura's life changed forever when Guy died by suicide. He was 67. 5 years later, Laura wrote a memoir, Losing the Garden, A Story of a Marriage, in which she tried to make sense of it. But it has taken more than one book for her to understand what happened to Guy and to her. Now, at the age of 84, Laura Waterman has a new memoir, Calling Wild Places Home. I recently visited Laura Waterman in her log house in East Corinth to talk about her books and her life. Her home is full of pictures of her and Guy in the mountains and on their Vermont homestead, which they called Barra. It's obvious as we walk around that Guy continues to have a strong presence in her life. A note for our listeners. This conversation discusses suicide. If you are in crisis or need help for someone else, dial 988 for the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, formerly known as the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, or text 741741 for the crisis text line. Laura Waterman, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you, David. Happy to be here.
Let's begin by just, I'd love you to introduce us to your home, because home has been central in your life and the changing locales. Tell us about the home that we're sitting in now.
Well, when my husband died in 2000, I moved to this house. I'm giving you a very short version, actually, because he and I had planned it together, and we actually had it built by a friend, John Niniger, of the Wooden House Company. And so its beams went up in late January. Wait a minute. Yeah, late January 2000. He put the thing together. It's a log house. And I moved into it in June 2000. And it's a very convenient house for me because I can walk to the village. It's like a 10 or 15 minute walk. I have everything I need in the village, which is the post office and the library.
It's a big difference from, what was it, a mile and a half that you used to walk to your home through the woods.
Yes, it is. But it's a suitable, it's just the right distance for me as an older person.
So you and Guy had planned a home for you that you would occupy after his death, that you both
Correct.
Knew about was coming.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a remarkable degree of planning and intention. So you could see your future.
Yes, and he could see it too.
And so, Guy, that gave him some peace of mind.
Yes, I know it did. Yes, and it did for me too. But, you know, it's not surprising that it happened that way because we have worked so closely together on writing projects and climbing and our homesteading. So in a way, it was a natural extension.
We're going to return to the story of Guy's passing, but I want to first get people oriented to your coming to Vermont and your journey here and your homesteading years. You grew up, your father was a teacher at the Lawrenceville School in New Jersey.
Correct.
Very well-known prep school.
Yes.
He was an Emily Dickinson scholar.
Absolutely.
So talk about how you go from, you know, the suburbs of New Jersey and a prominent prep school to a life off the grid in the woods in Vermont.
That's a very good question, David. And I don't know as I can really give a very good answer. I think partly, well, I began living in New York the year that I graduated from college, which was 1962.
And where was college?
Hollins College in Virginia. Very rural. The Appalachian Trail went across our back campus. But I majored in English, and I felt I didn't want to be a teacher, and I didn't want to be a librarian, and I didn't want to be a mother either at that point.
You knew at a young age you were not interested.
I was not ready to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but I loved books, and I thought, and I was surrounded by books growing up, basically, because of what you just said about my dad. And
but in 1962, for a young woman to decide she was not interested in having a family, that's a pretty radical idea at that time.
Well, it was good that I made that I was feeling that way about it, because I don't think any marriage would have lasted very long if I had gotten married then.
So you were an independent thinker from an early age.
Well, I think I was just doing what I felt was right for me.
Mm-hmm. And so you go from college, you go into publishing, I suppose, not surprisingly.
Yeah.
And so you are living the life you kind of was meant for, were meant for. You were living a literary life and immersed in literature.
It took me about a year to get used to living in New York, because I'd never lived in anything more than a small town, really. And I had always had summers open, and of course now I didn't. But I grew to actually love New York, and I'm very extremely grateful for those close to 10 years that I was living there. And then what changed it for me was that the publishing company I was working for closed its New York office, or actually downsized it to practically nothing. So I didn't have a job. And I thought, this would have been 1967.
Who was the publisher?
Bob's Merrill Publishing Company. They published the Wizard of Oz books.
Okay.
And and this was in early spring, and I thought, well, I'm going to take a trip, a long trip. And I decided, I had heard about people going on freighters and the freighters stopping at all the interesting ports. And I ended up taking a trip on a Greek freighter that stopped at just about everything around the entire Mediterranean, like in other words, North Africa, over to Istanbul and up into the Black Sea. And then I got off in Genoa and spent another month or so in Europe. And when I got back to New York, I actually had lined up a job for myself at Oxford University Press before I left. They were willing to have me come back in September. So I showed up, and then I feel like I'm going into too much detail.
Yeah, why don't we, how did you meet Guy?
Good question. Okay, I changed publishers again, ended up working for Athenaeum Books, and I think I was not, like, I wasn't, something wasn't right. I mean, I had left New York, and I tried to fit back into publishing, and it wasn't a good fit anymore. And somehow, I had found out about the Appalachian Mountain Club, and I saw that they had a rock climbing program for beginners. And so I made that phone call and to register for their beginning rock climbing at the Kungs. This would have been fall of 69.
And this is the Gunks, is the Schwangunks, the cliffs outside New Paltz, New York. Very famous climbing destination.
Very famous.
I've spent many weekends there.
We'll have to talk about that. So Guy Wunderman was part of that, the AMC group. We didn't really get together. He was recently separating from his wife, and he wasn't wanting to connect with anybody for a while. So we really didn't begin to have a conversation until the spring of 1970. But he actually was anxious to get out of New York. He was working for General Electric. He had given up a fascinating job in Washington, D.C., writing speeches for senators and congressmen.
Including Dwight Eisenhower and Gerry Ford.
Correct.
So you can say soon-to-be presidents.
Yeah, Eisenhower.
Yes.
After he retired.
Oh, after he retired, yeah. Okay.
He wrote for, he wrote for three presidents, none of whom were president at the time.
So besides Eisenhower and Ford, who was the third?
Eisenhower.
Ford, yeah. And the third president?
Eisenhower, Ford, and who did we say?
I'm not sure. Nixon? Was Nixon?
Well, he did do, for Nixon, but for the election that he lost to Kennedy.
Ah, early 60s. Okay, the 1960 election.
Yeah. So he was looking for ways to be able to climb more and find a way to support himself that was out of the city. And I think that was a time when a lot of people, youngish people, were looking for something else.
And how did you end up coming to East Corinth, Vermont?
Well, we first had to decide that it was homesteading that we were interested in. And we took what the Nearings, Helen and Scott Nearing, had to say in their books very seriously. And we felt that it offered us a path, and we felt that we could do the same. So we took a summer to, we probably looked at close to 100 pieces of property. And it was the land in East Corinth that had that met our requirements.
So tell me about life in Barra and explain what Barra means. That's the name you gave your homestead.
Barra is an isle in the Hebrides, and Guy's mother's ancestral roots were there.
So what was life like for you there?
That's a pretty big question. Well, we were full-time homesteaders, but we were doing it on a pretty bare bones we were basically living on money that we had set aside for doing this. We knew we would need to support ourselves by doing more than growing vegetables. But that was how the writing fit into being what we call, the Unearings called a cash crop. So running was our cash crop. Yeah. Meanwhile, we were living very simply, a mile and a half walk. We could park on our property, and that shortened the road, the walk a bit. We had no electricity. It was really pretty much before solar power got to be popular. We had a nice stream that we got water from.
You've described it, and I, in your books, your memoirs, you've described that you lived on about $3,000 a year in freelance writing income. You were hauling water, chopping wood, and living life off the grid. And you've described it as like living in the 19th century.
That's true.
What did you like about it, and what made it worth all the hard work that it took?
It was very satisfying. We were basically outside most of the day. It was very physical. There were no telephones. There were no cars shooting by. That we had a lot of control. And of course, we had to live within what nature dictated. So we didn't have, so it was basically the seasons we were paying attention to, or the weather we were having. I mean, nature really was calling the shots.
When you lived off of what you grew, basically?
Yeah, we did.
And so you were vegetarians?
Yeah.
And you could grow everything you needed?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we needed to go to the supermarket for toilet paper or
right.
paper towels. Or, I got butter at the supermarket. Sometimes we might have brought a fruit that we wanted, but yes.
And you were deep into the outdoors, climbing, hiking. How did that fit into your life?
It fit very well. I mean, the reason for leaving New York and choosing to live in this very simplified way was basically to leave more time for climbing mountains. And it basically fit very well into how we needed to earn money writing. And I would say that we were very influenced by, this is going back to when we were climbing at the Kungs, it was at that moment in the early 70s that climbers were beginning to think about the impact that they had on the cliffs themselves and the kind of protection that they used, pounding the pitons into the cracks.
Which had been the convention in the 60s. But in the 70s, an environmental ethic kind of came in, and the idea was to leave no trace, to not deface the cliffs.
Yes.
And you and Guy were writing about environmental ethics. You wrote two books and many articles, but Backwoods Ethics, Wilderness Ethics were two of your books, which have been cited as kind of the inspiration for what we now call the Leave No Trace movement. Why was environmental ethics so important to you?
Well, I think because we saw the damage that many footsteps have, and we loved the mountains, and we felt it was important to. We knew that all those hikers that were going up also loved the mountains, and we were just trying to heighten awareness as to, you know, how they could see clearly what their footsteps are doing, and by sticking to the paths.
And you had an especially up close view of this, because you and Guy adopted one of the most popular hiking trails in the Northeast, as you were the stewards of it, and that's the Franconia Ridge Trail, which, for anybody who's been over in Franconia Notch, it is that gorgeous above tree line trail at around 5,000 feet.
Right.
Why that trail? Why were you so in love with that trail?
Well, for just everything you just said. And it's unique, really. It's been called a knife edge. It's not really a knife edge, but, I mean, you're not going to fall off either side of it, but it's a very narrow ridge. It's not like the Presidentials, which are just huge mountainous shoulders. And there's very airy, very open, very it's hard to describe. It's just,
yes, you can see for you have 100 mile views, but you also have views of the hundreds and hundreds of hikers who you'll meet on it on a nice weather weekend.
That's true.
And so you and Guy were concerned about managing the, you know, how do you keep it from being loved to death?
Right. Now, we were a part of the Appalachian Mountain Club's caretaker program, really. They were making it, they were opening the opportunity to people like us who were volunteers,
right,
to adopt a ridge or to adopt a trail. And when we heard the AMC was doing that, we volunteered to take on the Franconia Ridge Trail. Mm-hmm. It was close. I mean, we were living on close to the Connecticut River in Vermont, and so it took us an hour and 20 minutes from our house to get over there. So that was definitely a reason for adopting it as well. But basically, it's the beauty of it. And when we were doing our work up there, we were frequently picking up scree walls or scree. We were picking up rocks that had come off the scree walls and putting them back on the scree wall or adding them to a cairn. And people would stop us and say, "What are you doing?" And we would explain why we were doing this, that we were basically wanting to make the path as nice to walk on as possible, so that people would walk on the path and not wander all over stepping on the plants.
Let me ask you about some of your own climbing exploits. You have a number of very notable mountaineering credits to your name. You've done all women presidential traverse in the White Mountains, an all women expedition up Katahdin in Maine. And you were an early climber of one of the most famous ice climbs in the Northeast on Cannon Cliff in Franconia Notch, called the Black Dyke, which Patagonia founder Yvon Chouinard famously called a black, filthy, horrendous icicle that he believed would never be climbed. So climbing when did you climb the Black Dyke? This is a fearsome ice climbing route.
That was in March 1975, and we were the fifth or sixth ascent. In the first couple, I was the first woman to do that climb.
You were the first woman.
Yeah.
So you were obviously a very accomplished ice climber to get up that. What gave you the vision to think that you could do that, and the courage? These are scary places.
Well, we've been ice climbing for quite a number of years by that time, and so it was sort of, yes, it was a step up, but we were ready for it. I think we both felt that.
You have been part of these all-women mountaineering feats. Tell me what that means to you and why you were committed to that, to showing that, to being part of all-women groups.
Well, I think that's how women were thinking back then in the 70s, going into the early 80s, that when we were with our husbands or our boyfriends, there was little opportunity for us, for women, to make decisions. I mean, they could contribute, but often they weren't listened to. And we began to realize that if we wanted to be able to learn to lead at all, there couldn't be a man anywhere around, certainly not in the party, because it's their natural instinct to take over, and it's probably the natural instinct of women to step aside.
What changes when it's all women?
Gosh. It might become a little more, most of the trips that I did with other women were in very small groups, like one or two others. So we were all responsible. There wasn't really a leader. So it was very cooperative.
And very democratic.
Yeah.
You wrote your first memoir just a few years after Guy's death. What led you to write a second memoir over 20 years after his death?
Well, that was it. 20 years after his death, I had a lot to think about. Still, he took his own life, and it was planned very meticulously. And he drew me into his decision to do that. And I needed to write the second memoir to understand better my role in Guy's suicide. And it took, you know, I think that 20 years was, I needed that 20 years to live with that and basically grow into the person that I needed to become.
Laura Waterman explained how her husband Guy was originally not planning to tell her about his decision to end his life. One evening, he told her that he attempted to die by suicide earlier that day.
I was surprised, obviously, but I knew, because I knew him very well, that he was determined to do this. And I said, if you're planning to take your own life, I need to be in a better situation. And he heard that. Then he said that basically he wanted to go off, you know, like next week or a few days later. And I was not going to let that happen. And somehow we managed to talk it out. And he understood that he needed basically to take responsibility for me. And if he was determined to take his own life, he had to make sure I was well taken care of in the sense of where I would live. And so he spent another 18 months together, and basically it was very healing time in a strange way, because we were going through our year of work, planting the garden, collecting wood, sugaring, and we were basically saying goodbye to Vera together. And so when the opportunity came and he felt that I was set to go on without him, we had also found a piece of property, made contact with the builder, who was a friend of ours, and he knew that I would be able to take care of myself very well.
Did you try to persuade him not to do it?
Of course, I did. And whenever I attempted to do that, you know, the stone wall went up, and he just was, it only pulled us apart instead of bringing us together. I should say that when he was a teenager in high school, he had his parents were concerned about him, and his teachers were concerned, and they took him to a psychiatrist, and he spent a little time, you know, with a psychiatrist, and it was a very poor fit, and it really set him against psychiatry.
You describe, so you write this first memoir, Losing the Garden, the Story of a Marriage, and you went on a reading, and I think you say it was a bookstore in Peterborough, New Hampshire, where a woman from the audience said, how could you have supported your husband's plan to commit suicide? And that you were very shaken by the question. But
yes.
It's kind of an obvious question, isn't it?
Very. Yeah, she said, why didn't you stop him? And it happened that I knew There were some very good friends of mine who were in the audience who knew Guy very well. And they said in chorus, she couldn't have stopped him. But, and this is, I think, the important point. I spent a lot of time writing Losing the Garden, but I never really answered that question. Why couldn't I stop him? And that was a big reason why I began the second memoir. And I think, actually, I came to a much better understanding of myself from writing the second memoir. And I think that, I hope my readers will feel that I have answered that question. For myself, I feel I have.
And how do you answer that question now? Because it inspired you to write a whole book. So for people who maybe aren't going to read the book, but would love to hear you, what is your insight now?
Well, I think a lot of it had to do with my own personality and that for the purposes of writing the book, I called myself a piglet. And I'm thinking of Winnie the Pooh, the A.A. Milne books. And Piglet was a very agreeable little animal. And he wanted to do the right thing, and he wanted people to have a good time and enjoy themselves. And
a pleaser.
Hmm?
A pleaser.
Yes. And that's my personality. I'm a piglet.
You write, you reflect on the difference between supporting and enabling,
yeah,
a partnership versus codependency. So you're kind of digging deeper now into sort of seeing what that, as you call it, a piglet, there are other names for it now. Do you feel like, well, 20 years after Guy's death, do you feel like you were equal partners, or that you were kind of in his shadow?
Well, I think I was very much under his shadow. And it happened as soon as I met him. I would have denied that until I wrote the second memoir, because I was so under his shadow that I couldn't see it. He had a lot of charisma. I wasn't the only one who was under his shadow. And that was the kind of person that he was. And me being completely drawn in, I think that's the other thing that I saw from writing the second memoir.
You write in, you know, in your relationship and in your first memoir, you spoke of his demons. But of course, that's not how we speak of mental illness today. And in this book, you speak more candidly about mental illness. What do you think, Guy, going beyond the idea of demons, what is your thought now on what Guy was dealing with?
You mean to the name of his mental illness?
Well, just the nature of his mental illness and the fact that you now refer to it as mental illness.
Well, I think he was troubled with depression. I don't know enough about mental illness to really, I can't diagnose, but he definitely had his up days and his down days. And so I was living with that. I never stopped loving Guy. I could be mad at him. We never had, and this is probably not a good thing, but we never really had arguments. Neither one of us wanted to have arguments. And he was very good at blocking. You know, the stone wall would go up, and I was only making myself more unhappy by trying to crash that down. It was better to just step away. We would find each other again. And I think really that I never ceased to love him.
To this day, because yes, your home is much filled with images of Guy.
Yeah.
Talk about your life since. You've now, it's 24 years after Guy took his life.
Yeah.
There's a lovely TV clip that you did with Willem Lang, who's known to many Vermonters as a wonderful storyteller. And Willem tells you that he finds your writing after Guy refreshing. Like, he says, like you were writing uphill. And you said that surprised you when he said that. How do you feel like you've changed since Guy's death?
I feel that I become much more my own person. And I don't know. I think I feel grown into myself.
Do you feel like your writing has changed?
The writing has been great, really. The writing is a very important part of my life. And I feel very lucky to be a writer. I feel lucky that my entire life has been so surrounded by books, by writers, by publishers. It's been a very, very book-oriented life.
Who is the Laura Waterman who has come out? If you were under a shadow, who is the Laura that has emerged from that shadow? How is she different?
I think I'm a lot more honest because I've learned how to be honest to myself.
How did you get there? How do you get to be more honest with yourself?
I think by writing memoir. I mean, I've fallen in love with a memoir form. It has a lot of, it borrows on fiction as well as nonfiction. Its purpose is to tell the truth. And that only can happen, for me at any rate, with repeated rewrites. It's very exciting, it's very scary, it's very fulfilling, it's very satisfying. Really was the perfect answer for me to continue with my life and basically continue being a writer.
You write that your new book, Calling Wild Places Home, is a joyous book, although it spends a lot of time revisiting a tragedy, your husband's suicide. Explain.
I wrote that sentence very near the end of writing the book, and I think what it meant then was, you know, I ended up feeling joyous about it because the book turned out to, I explained myself to myself by writing the book, and that can't help but be joyous.
You also write that age has increased your joy of being in the mountains, and yet you're more limited now in where you can go just because you're physically more limited, although you look wonderful and you move around great, but obviously climbing big mountains does have an expiration date on it for most people. Why is it more joyful for you now in the mountains?
It's joyful in a different way. My goals are different. I mean, when Guy and I were running up and down the Franconia Ridge or the 4,000 footers or climbing ice, that was joyful too, but in a less thoughtful way. I think now when I'm out in the woods with a friend or two or just by myself, and I think getting older, I'm just so glad to be able to still be out there, you know, to stand on a summit.
What's a summit you've been to lately?
Let's see. Going back to this fall, I spent my 84th birthday on Bald Peak, which is on a spur trail going up the Kinsman Ridge Trail. Hmm. And I couldn't think of a, I mean, how could you not be joyful? I was with three other friends that we hiked together. Really every Tuesday we walked together. And
You're still climbing mountains.
Yeah. Yes.
What has become of Barra? What has become of Barra, your old homestead?
Yeah, there's someone living there now. It's not really being kept up so much as a homestead, but it is occupied.
Have you been back there? No.
No.
Is it too hard for you?
It's changed. It's changed enough so that I don't really need to come back and see it. Hmm.
You've written, you know, these remarkable histories of hiking and climbing and mountaineering in the Northeast, among the many accomplishments you have. What are you proudest of as you look at your body of work and your exploits?
Oh my gosh, I just feel so fortunate. I'm fortunate to be able to climb mountains, smaller ones. I'm very fortunate to be writing what I'm writing. I'm fortunate to have a good agent. I'm fortunate to have a typist who allows me to use my typewriter.
Is there a climb that stands out in your mind as one that you're really proudest of?
Well, the Black Dyke. That was definitely a triumphal day for us.
Yeah. If Guy were sitting at this table now, what would you say to him? You're still answering for how he lived his life and how he ended his life.
Yeah. I think he'd be very, very happy with what I've done with my life in the last 20 years. I think basically I'm doing exactly what he hoped I would do.
Hmm. Well, Laura Waterman, it's been an honor and a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Laura Waterman's latest book is Calling Wild Places Home, a memoir in essays. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.